I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We're about to have a conversation with Roya Hakakian, who has been on the show before for books that she's written. She's an author of two incredible books. The first one was A Journey from the Land of No, A Girlhood Caught in Revolutionary Iran, and Assassins of the Turquoise Palace. And as I was reading the New York Times last week, I ran across her opinion piece, What Two Enemies Share, which had to do with Iran and Israel and her life as a woman who is Jewish and also born in Iran, who took part in the revolution that overthrew the Shah. It's particularly appropriate today because today in the Jewish community, this is the fast of Esther, the beginning of the holiday of Purim, which is a holiday built around the Jewish Persian experience. So it couldn't be more appropriate. And I want to welcome you to our program. It's a pleasure to have you with us, Roya.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's talk about this piece you wrote. I really was fascinated by it because of all the political turmoil that is flying around us when it comes to Iran and the and nuclear weapons and Israel and the United States. This approach of taking it from a woman whose soul lives in both places.
Absolutely. I mean, we live in an age where the notion of purity has become completely outdated. And we're all from elsewhere, and we all have relatives or parents who give us 20% of some other culture in our genes. And I think it's, as a result, it's very difficult to say that we are on this side or the other of the issues. I think we all share the troubles that are floating about in the world, and we need to find a way of addressing them in the most peaceful and least damaging way.
To take us back, for listeners who have not read your books yet and didn't hear other interviews together, when you were younger, 1979, you were in Iran, living there, born there. It was your country as a Jewish woman in Iran. Your brother had been, I remember from the book, arrested by the Shah. You had taken part in the movements in the streets. Take us back to that moment for just a moment to let our listeners get a sense of who you were at that place and time.
That's right. My brother, and I'm stunned that you remember any of it, was an artist in the early 70s in Iran and had drawn a couple of cartoons that my father just became really worried that might get him into trouble under the Shah, where there was no freedom of expression in Iran, and therefore sent him off to America to study, and that's where he has been ever since. And I became very much fascinated by the Iranian Revolution, by the idea that there could be freedom in Iran, and there are doors that could open onto a more democratic future for all of us, which of course a few years later, after 1979, proved to have been a faulty hope, a dream that turned into ashes for all of us, and a dream that I think continues in Iran to this day. I think in some ways the revolution that began in 1979 has yet to end. And what we saw in 2009 in the aftermath of the presidential elections in Iran is in some ways the continuation of the same revolution that I witnessed. The second book I wrote about very much speaks to the story that is unfolding as we speak, and that's the story of Iran's extrajudicial assassinations in various parts of the world. I focused on the story of one particular case, which occurred in Berlin, Germany, in 1992. The investigation, the heroic investigation by the prosecutor, German prosecutor Bruno Jost, and the very dramatic trial that went on for over 3 years and culminated in a historic verdict that many legal scholars with whom I spoke about this refer to as the most important trial in the history of Germany since Nuremberg. And the book is called Assassins of the Turquoise Palace.
It's an amazing book. I love the book, but I haven't interviewed you about that book, which I have to. Another day.
Of course.
So back to the piece that you wrote in The Place We're In Now in This World. Mm-hmm. You talk in the piece about your being in Tehran in the early 80s, part of a small group of socialist intellectuals who gathered together quietly, clandestinely, as you wrote. And it's so interesting, again, what you're faced with as an Iranian, a Persian woman, a Jewish woman who's in this group, and you end up with this conversation about the Palestinian conflict, which was your role, and saying Palestinians should have land returned while your relatives have fled Iran, living in those lands now because of the oppression that happened in Iran. And the contradiction you have to wrestle with at all times.
Yes. I mean, that's an ongoing story. That's an ongoing tension within my life and the lives of people who, like me, have this mixed identity as part of their constitutional makeup. I think that, you know, whether it's by absolute knowledge or by ignorance, there is a lot that non-Jewish Iranians and Jewish Iranians don't know about each other, and that those things have gone on for as long as I remember. And I think the fact that we have not found a way of communicating with each other has only been sort of an underpinning of some of these tensions. It doesn't account for everything, but it does account for at least part of the reason why very good individuals on both sides of this do not seem to strike a sane position. I think the public can be far more sympathetic to the question of Jews, to the fact that Jews, in fact, do need to have a country and do have, you know, a right to be in the land where they live, and vice versa. And, you know, Jews who need to understand that Iranians are people who are not represented by their leaders.
One of the lines in here made me think about this morning as I was talking to my youngest daughter about this day, and that one of the ways that people look at the story of Esther, who married the Persian king that created this holiday Purim that we're around, was in many ways about the power of a woman. And we don't always talk about that. It's always men in these things, but the power of a woman. Mm-hmm. But it was also about, in some ways, how when you wrote the lines, silence and submissiveness were and are the cornerstones of the character of the Iranian Jew.
Mm-hmm.
It made me think of that story because it was the same way.
Right, right. I mean, Esther had not revealed, according to the myth, had not revealed that she was a Jew to the king until the time that the order for killing of Jews gets approved by the king, thanks to Haman. And I think that is very much emblematic of what went on for centuries and continues to go on in Iran, that we keep ourselves obscure. And, of course, that has been a necessity, under unfriendly circumstances that Jews have lived in inside Iran. But I think to some degree it even when it wasn't necessary, it had become a part of who we were and a part of how we were as Jews. And even when we had the possibility of changing it, it felt unnatural, and so we didn't. And I see that that as being part of what we somehow need to change. One of the things that stuns me, even as we speak, is the fact that, you know, the president of Iran, Ahmadinejad, has spent millions of dollars on his anti-Islamic anti-Semitic, anti-Israel, anti, you know, Holocaust denying habits. You know, he allocated $20 million to a miniseries to be broadcast, to be produced for the Iranian television, and it was the most expensive miniseries that Iran has ever produced in all of its television history. And it was about a 10-part series called Zero Degree Orbit about the Holocaust. It was shot on location, which no other Iranian television project had ever had the opportunity of. And it was meticulously produced, given what they, you know, given their standards of quality. And you know, when I think what it is that American Jews and we on the other side try to do, there isn't very much that we do in communicating who we are, what we have suffered, what is our counter-narrative to the ones that he and, you know, he is producing through his propaganda machinery. So somehow we have given up as Jews on the project of public relations, on the whole notion that we could have friends, and it is possible to communicate with other people around the world, even within the seemingly hostile region of the Middle East, in order to win hearts and minds.
In the spirit of that, to tell the story that you talk of in a few sentences about in your piece in the New York Times about Abdul Hussein Sadari, because I think it's a story that is unknown to most of the world, and it speaks loudly to what you're talking about.
Right. It's the story that actually will shortly be a book by an Iranian scholar who has been working on this for many years and is you know, the best person in position to talk about it. But it's the story of Iran's ambassador to Paris at the time of World War II, who tries to save and does save the lives of thousands of Jews by issuing them papers, by issuing them passports and other documents that gets them out of Europe and brings many of them into Iran and or elsewhere around the world. It's the story of Iranian Schindler.
I mean, that to me is a story that, and when you write about this, the Polish cemetery that exists inside it in Tehran, while Ahmadinejad is doing his Holocaust denial routine, there are descendants of the Jews who were saved by Iran placing flowers on graves.
And there is a wonderful little documentary about this that an Iranian filmmaker produced inside Iran. It didn't get permission to air or come to festivals, but there is a documentary, and I think pieces of it do exist on YouTube. But it's the story of how Jewish refugees make their way out of Siberia and come to Iran as sort of an intermediary point to Israel and other parts of the world, and are so warmly received by the Iranians, you know, at the end of the war, that some of them do decide to stay, and therefore, suddenly after, you know, in the mid 40s in Iran, there is a population of Polish Poles in Iran who bring in lots of things to Iran, including polka dancing. And therefore, there is a relatively large Polish cemetery in Tehran to this day.
It was interesting. I read somewhere else that you was it last November, or maybe I have it, may have the year wrong, that you you spoke for the Democratic Caucus.
Yes.
About your book and also about this whole situation with Iran.
Last December, yes.
Right. And what did you say to them?
I basically talked to them about my new book, the one that you and I are going to talk about at some point,
right.
in order to give them sort of a sense of what it is that we need to know about the history of, first and foremost, Iran's notorious activities against its own citizens, and also what it is that has been effective in dealing with the regime on that front. You know, the trial that I write about culminates in a verdict that is the greatest blow that the Iranian regime has ever suffered since 1979, delivered to it by the international community. And yet, none of the people at the caucus that I spoke to knew the story or knew the significance of it. I'm kind of leaving aside the story of, you know, the effectiveness of, mm-hmm. of the sanctions that have gone into effect in the last couple of months. But up until then, this verdict that was issued from the court and the subsequent position that every European government that had somehow been involved in the trial struck had been the only instance of the most effective thing that the international community had ever done vis-a-vis Iran. So I talked to them about, you know, getting to know this history, not because I, as an exile, felt nostalgic about the past or thought that history has to be preserved, but rather as something that can be kind of a guiding light through this time when we're all trying to figure out what it is that we can do about Iran short of a military attack.
And short of a military attack, I mean, to get to the heart and soul of what you wrote about in terms of the unknown bonds that Israel and Iran share, that Muslims and Jews share, really.
Yeah.
I mean, is it the heart of what you're telling people right now?
Yes. I mean, from a purely pragmatic stance, looking at it purely as a Jew, I think to myself, how long can we expect Israel to you know, to solve its problems through, you know, military invasion, attack, bombing. I mean, there has to come a point where we, as Jews, feel that we can find other ways of solving our disagreements. And the fact that we have become, albeit by force, albeit by circumstances, this belligerent nation who threatened war is very disheartening to me. I think of us. I mean, I'm not a very good Jew by many standards, but I do feel culturally and you know, in a lot of other ways, very very much part of the Jewish tradition and culture, and yet I think this position that we have kind of cornered ourselves in, or have been cornered into, however we define it, is one that we have to break out of. I mean, we can't constantly try to solve the problems that we face in such a way. And that's not to mention the fact that I think that historically, we have been the progressive ones. We have been the ones who have been the champions of the poor, of the downtrodden, of those who needed to get justice, and so on and so forth. And I just want to see us back in that role again. Mm-hmm. And I think Iran, in fact, of all the places in the Middle East, is the one country where this can happen, at this particular time. I mean, Iranians have been so against their own regime. They have suffered so greatly at the hands of this current regime that they no longer buy its propaganda, or at least they treat its propaganda with a great deal of suspiciousness. And I think this provides a wonderful opportunity for Israel, for Jews, to try to, you know, win over again hearts and minds of the Iranian public, or at least try to communicate the counter-argument and the counter-narrative. And I think a lot can change through, you know, winning over one nation, especially in Iran, where a lot of trends within the region always get set. You know, the region was changed by the emergence of Ayatollah Khomeini in 1979. The region was changed as a result of the Iranian Revolution, and you know, so many of these countries later on followed Iran's lead. And I think the reverse can be true too. That if we if Israel begins to try to make headway through Iran, through a nation with whom it has to be able to create this sense of camaraderie, because the hostility against the regime is something that both Israelis and Iranians share, then by seizing on that opportunity, by creating a foothold within the public's imagination, a lot can turn.
I think it's a very important thing you just said. Sometimes it's important, I think, to what you're... The reason I was so struck by what you wrote and why I'm so struck by what you're saying this evening on our program is that for us to realize what the future and what the reality is that we're facing, you have to go beyond just the politics.
Mm-hmm.
You have to talk about who people are as people, who they are as peoples, as cultures, which is what I think you're trying to do.
Right, absolutely. I mean, one of the things that I mentioned in the piece is that, you know, Israeli engineers and Iranian
Jews
had played a major role in industrializing Iran in 20th century under the Shah. You know, we owe a lot of major bridges, major highways, and other infrastructural buildings and monuments to the presence of Israeli engineers in Iran in the 50s, 60s, and the 70s. And the patriotism of Iranian Jews who were, you know, major industrialists who also felt very much as Iranians who had deep roots within within that region, and therefore, we're invested in bettering the country. And I think, I was stunned that I didn't know the story. I learned it through a couple of those Iranian Jews who had been involved in constructing these bridges and roads. And second of all, that these stories are virtually unknown. And the fact that Iran had this moment of industrialization, urbanization, is one of the most important reasons. It's not the only reason, but among the most important reasons why Iran, for instance, isn't Afghanistan today. There is a lot that Iran could have shared with its immediate neighbors, with Iraq, with Pakistan, with Afghanistan. And the reason it doesn't, in part, has to do with the Pahlavis and the industrialization and the urbanization that took place, which in part broke up, you know, isolated pockets of ethnic presence and connected the entire country via highways and roads and bridges. And these things kind of broke up that previously tribal structure that the country had been living in for centuries. And therefore, you know, Iranians, despite, you know, everything that has politically gone wrong in Iran, continue to remain a productive and relatively modern nation. It is important for these things to be recorded, to be remembered, to be learned, not simply because, you know, history is a good thing and we all need to know what happened or what the truth is. That's part of it. But the other part is, in light of that knowledge, many of us may be seeing things in an entirely different light. And I think And I'm hoping that this is what happens with kind of further probing into the history of the presence of Jews in Iran and all the things that Iranian Jews and Muslims, Iranian Muslims, have done in order to help each other throughout the centuries.
Ruya Hakakian, that was just a wonderful way to kind of conclude our conversation, what you just said. And if you don't mind, what I'd like to really conclude with is your last sentence, if I might. Do you
sure.
mind?
Not at all.
When you wrote in the end of the article, by bombing Iran, Israel would be bombing a portion of Jewish history. If that happens, which side would I choose will not be a question. I will be twice destroyed by the two imperfect yet beloved cultures that make up half of the woman I am. And Roya, thank you so much. It's always an honor and pleasure to have you on the show.
It's same with me. Thank you so much for having me.
You're listening to The Mark Steiner Show, Public Radio, WEAA, 88.9 FM, the voice of the community. Don't go away. We'll be right back after this very short break.